but we are going to begin. The hour is upon us. So we are going to, as I understand, Mr. Meyer, go back to Game and Fish, Fish and Wildlife.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Would you want to introduce yourself to the record this morning?
To the record, Tom Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. I have with me Dan Shad, our Division Director for the Division of Fish and Wildlife. What I would like to do today is continue where we left off with the Fish and Wildlife Division, move into enforcement. I think we can complete those two sections for sure this morning. If we have time, begin the forestry discussion, continue that tonight. And then we just have our operations support section and a brief wrap-up. So with any luck, we will be out of where we will be done today. It's just a matter of what time. But I plan on finishing as early as possible. So thank you for bearing with us.
You are right. We will finish this today. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess this is technically a technical question. Can I ask a question of the presenters about this slide now, or do you want me to wait?
Well, why don't you let them give one word of introduction and then ask a question about that slide.
Okay.
Because I think that's what we're ready to begin with.
Madam Chair, yes, we're starting on slide 19. You'll see, hopefully everybody still has their packet of information from last time. This legislative initiative or budget initiative deals with wildlife disease management. And what we're requesting is $132,000 to help us with the work of emerging issues. Continue our tuberculosis, bovine TB surveillance in northwest Minnesota, and allow us to coordinate with the Minnesota Board of Animal Health and USDA programs that are out there. The target that we have is to collect and analyze samples from approximately 1,000 wild deer annually to ensure the TB status. There is a huge issue right now in deer control that we're working on in this area of the slide. Actually, today, Director Shad has informed me that they will start harvesting some of these potentially infected animals up there. We need to reduce the herd to zero, if at all possible, within this target range. You'll see just in Roseau County, south of War Road, because of the outbreak of bovine TB and the ability of these animals to spread the bovine TB from one herd to the other. We're working with landowners and all interested parties up in that region to control the herd as much as possible. So this, you'll see, going back again to the fact sheets, Madam Chair, it's outlined in your fact sheet packet on page 49 exactly what we would do with these funds. If I can get to that. So as I mentioned before, this initiative is $132,000 of new general fund for FY08, would carry it forward to the next biennium as well to continue these activities.
Representative Poppy has a question for you.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and feel free to tell me that this is something we would more properly discuss at another time. But last year I had a bill that would have prohibited the shooting of big game, what people call hunting in game preserves. And one of the reasons that I was a strong supporter of that proposed legislation was because of the disease potential for having infected animals, both deer and elk, bring chronic wasting disease and other diseases like bovine tuberculosis into our native cervidae populations. And if this happened, it would be devastating. It has been devastating in other states where it has happened. And I would like to pursue something like that again. I don't have a bill this year, but perhaps somebody else might have a bill this year that would address that. And I just wonder if one of our testifiers would want to say a couple of words about that, or if we at some point in the future could spend some more time talking about a potentially devastating impact to a Minnesota resource.
Can certainly talk about it now. I think that's also a good topic for the committee that you and I sit on Monday afternoon.
I agree.
I would think that would be a good topic. Did you want to make some comments?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Poppe. Again, for the record, my name is Dave Shad, Director of the Fish and Wildlife Division. And you're right, this is a related concern. Where we've had diseases in deer here, whether it's, in this case, TB, it did have an origin from cattle. In other states that have found CWD, chronic wasting disease, in their wild deer herds or elk herds, it's suspected that the origin there was captive deer and elk herds as well. So we're one of the reasons that we're concerned about wildlife disease management is this interaction between deer and captive animals, whether they're deer and elk or cattle. And again, with the shooting or the hunting behind the fences, one of our concerns is that's going to result in a lot of movement of animals between farms and from other states into Minnesota. And with that increased movement, it brings with that increased risk of disease transmission. And so you're right, it is a very related issue and one we continue to be very concerned about.
Your budget doesn't say how much you're spending on wildlife disease management right now. In the last year, what did you spend?
Madam Chair, I'll have to pull the details of that budget together, and it's kind of a complicated mix. We have been successful in securing some federal funding to help with the bovine TB effort. We also had a very ambitious testing program for wild birds for avian influenza this last year, and we've continued our monitoring and surveillance for chronic wasting disease. These are all programs that we weren't spending any money or time on just 5 years ago. This is a real emerging issue for us, one that we're spending more and more time. We do have a wildlife disease specialist on staff now and an assistant for that person. But as far as details of the budget, I'll have to get that to you later. I know we did receive, I believe, $400,000 to $500,000 from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to assist in the bovine tuberculosis monitoring. We also received significant federal funds for the avian influenza monitoring that we did. The dollars here that we're asking for are just to develop kind of a base program with the staffing that we need to be able to respond to these kind of emerging issues.
I think it would be helpful if you would, since it's only been 4 or 5 years since you spent significant money on this, to give us a 4 or 5 year, would that be helpful, Representative Poppe?
I think so.
Yeah, and so we know, because just as with other invasives, it does seem to be that these are not quite, they're no longer emerging. They're something we have to deal with. Representative Hansen is next, and then Representative Anzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up on Representative Poppe's question, Mr. Shad, does overpopulation of deer impact some of these disease issues?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, it's a related issue. And certainly once a disease would get into wildlife population, especially deer, that higher population would tend to perpetuate the disease in the population. In fact, that's the reason why we're up in northwestern Minnesota in the middle of this bullseye here, starting today, culling deer with sharpshooters, federal sharpshooters. It's to try to reduce the deer population, in part to remove any infected animals that might be out there, but also to reduce transmission between those infected animals and other animals in the population. With the lower density of animals, you reduce the chances of animal-to-animal transmission.
Just to follow up, are there certain areas of the state where we have significant overpopulation of deer?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, there are, although we have been very aggressive, probably more aggressive than any other Great Lakes state for sure, in trying to keep on top of those deer populations. for the most part, where we've got populations that are much higher than we'd like, they're the result of refuge situations or situations where hunting is very limited or difficult. Urban areas, for example, would be one of those situations. By and large, we've got populations that are high because of the lack of severe winters in recent years. We're seeing increasing challenges in trying to keep on top of those populations, and have come up with a number of measures here to try to increase harvest of deer and become more effective at harvesting large numbers of deer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just a follow-up to the previous questions. It's my experience in the country where I live and where I move around on weekends during the session. The deer herd is in unbelievable condition. Numbers, I've lived there all my life, I've never seen numbers. All sizes, all classes, and it just begs the question, does research show correlation between these astronomical high numbers and the incidence of some of these invasive problems? And I'm sure you guys are continuing your research and study, but from a distance it sure looks like there has to be some correlation.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. Disease transmission is one of many reasons why we want to be very aggressive in trying to keep a lid on those deer populations.
Representative Scalise is next.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And Mr. Shad, is there a cost for the culling of the deer herd? And a second question, can that meat be consumed by humans, the bovine TB meat?
And Chair Representative Scalise, yeah, there is a cost. We've actually contracted with the U.S. Department of Agriculture for this culling operation. They've got teams of sharpshooters that have experience in doing this kind of work in other parts of the country. The contract is approximately $100,000. If it takes longer than expected, that price tag might go up. We're working to possibly secure some federal funds to kind of buy down the state's cost of that program, but we're not sure if those federal funds are going to come or not. As far as the safety of the meat, it is safe to eat with typical or normal cooking practices. A TB-infected deer would be safe to consume.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't ordinarily like to put people on the spot, but this morning we're just going to make an exception to that. I'm hoping when we go back to the chronic wasting disease, shooting preserve, survey legislation, that we can expect a strong support of the DNR for a ban on shooting preserves for survey only. Madam Chair, there seems to be something wrong with the mic.
Madam Chair, Representative Hoppe, we have been looking into the issue. We do have some concerns. We'll let you know what our official position is before too long. What was the bill?
Thank you.
We've made an invitation to you. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Director Meyer, I hope the deer are still here when you make a decision. That's been a little bit facetious there, you know that. Representative Hoppe and I both would like the DNR to take positions on tough issues a little more than maybe you have. And I know you're trying to walk a tightrope, but I guess I'd like to see a little more. Let us give us some direction sometimes, if you could. What my question really is, Director Shad, the area where the TB is in northwestern Minnesota is very close to this. Are precariously small elk herd. Are they in any danger, and would we actually be in a situation possibly where we'd have sharpshooters shooting these few elk we have up there?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, good question, and it is right in the vicinity of at least a portion of that northwestern elk herd. And we are concerned. That's one of the reasons why we're being pretty aggressive here with deer. And I should point out that there are some other measures being taken here to try to address this program. We implemented a feeding ban that was actually required by legislation last year in this area of the state, a deer feeding ban to try to remove that concentration of deer and that contact between deer that might lead to increased transmission of this disease. There's also some fencing that's planned to separate deer and cattle. And so there are a number of measures to protect both deer and elk and to try to remove this from deer, but also to help the cattle industry here and help them regain their TB-free status. That's very important economically for that industry as well.
Madam Chair, just real quick, so the elk can get it, and so it could transfer to the elk. Thank you.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it had been mentioned that it appears that the TB was starting in containment, places of containment where animals were being contained. In the case of the bovine TB here, were started with cattle herds. So I was wondering, is that really where the problem begins, where it's introduced, where you have containment? And if so, what the reasons are? I suppose it's because of animals being brought in that may have this. I understand that it spreads faster because of the containment, but why would it begin there? Does it ever begin in the wild, or should we be focusing on the containment areas?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Eakin, concentration of animals, whether it's cattle or deer, by itself doesn't create disease, but as you said, it increases the contact between those animals. If they're feeding from the same source of food, nose-to-nose contact, exchanging saliva, that kind of thing, it just increases the likelihood of transmission between animals. And that could be cattle to cattle, deer to deer, or cattle to deer in this case. And so one of our strategies is to try to separate cattle from deer through fencing and through modified feed handling practices on some of these cattle ranches. I think that's a very important strategy here. As far as the TB goes in the Northwest, this is a Mexican strain of TB that's only been found in cattle before. We strongly suspect, although we'll never be able to prove absolutely, that this disease was brought in by one animal, probably into one cattle operation, as that one animal might have infected several other animals. Those animals moved around between livestock operations. Deer had contact with one or more of those animals, and it got into the deer herd. So it's a complicated situation, but we would really like to, as a primary strategy here, try to separate deer and cattle to the extent we can.
Madam Chair, to that point?
Yes, sir.
And I'll keep it short. And to Representative Eakin, and I don't know about the TB, but as far as chronic waste disease goes, it was in the endemic area of Colorado for 35 or 40 years in the northeastern corner of the state, and a little bit into Nebraska and a little bit into Wyoming, but it stayed there. It didn't move. When we saw Cervidae farms, particularly elk farms, move across other states and provinces, you know, there's never been it's never been proven that there's a direct link between those operations and the chronic waste disease in the wild. But every state that has chronic wasting disease has the shooting preserves in the area, and we don't have any in Iowa or Minnesota or the eastern chunk of Nebraska. And then you start to see it in Wisconsin and some eastern states. So if it jumped, deer and elk can't fly. There had to be some way where it got from the endemic area to the areas where the shooting preserves are, or the game farms or whatever, places where they have the cervidae. So we've seen that, and no one really knows if it gets spread then through nose-to-nose contact through the fences, or fences come down and animals escape or something like that. But there's at least a very strong correlation there in how that's getting spread, and I'd just like to make sure it doesn't get spread here.
Representative Jody.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Can you tell us about how many private confinement areas we have in the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Doty, are you talking cattle operations?
No. The
farm survey operations?
Yes.
Yeah. It's about 750 is our best estimate. They do have to be licensed now through the Board of Animal Health. In fact, we're one of the largest, if not the largest, raisers of farmed cervids, farmed elk in the country.
Thank you.
And you might want to share with members when we started licensing those farms?
Madam Chair, about 1993. Previously, before that, they would have been regulated under the Department of Natural Resources game farm regulations. In 1993, they were actually classified as livestock, and regulation went to the Board of Animal Health at that time.
I can remember testimony, Representative Hoppe, from that time when we were absolutely assured that we'd never see any kind of diseases like bovine wasting disease in Minnesota, because it obviously did not. I mean, we can go back and check the record. I can remember those assurances and thinking. Well, anyway, I won't tell you what I was thinking, but I can remember those assurances. So I think you've gotten a good taste of folks, even at 8:30 in the morning, being very concerned. Take it to heart. Do you want to go on?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next initiative deals with our fishing tournament licensing fee. These costs historically have been borne out of the Game and Fish Fund. Working with our Budget Oversight Committee, or as our Budget Oversight Committees examine our expenditures out of those accounts, they determined that the Game and Fish Fund was subsidizing the cost of doing fishing tournament license processing. And you can see it from the slide, they've gone up from $15,000 a year to over $100,000 a year annually. What they recommended is that they recommended legislative action to cover the cost for administering the fishing contest permit program. Our goal is to have a net zero impact to the Game and Fish Fund. What we're proposing to do is to charge develop a fee structure that will cover our costs of managing these permits, but we will not be making any money off of it. As per statute in 16A, we cannot overcharge for our activities. So we're developing a fee structure and a schedule that will charge, that will recover our actual cost of processing these tournament fees. This is the first of many issues you're going to see and hear about dealing with an overall recommendation from the Budget Oversight Committee, in that wildlife dollars, or your deer and bear and other wildlife dollars, are subsidizing fishing activities. There's an imbalance in the account we're aware of. We're working very closely to try to figure out how to deal with that. You may hear from Budget Oversight Committee members on this issue. It's something we do understand, we do take very seriously, but the fix is not relatively easy. The activities do kind of overact or are commingled with a little bit of a degree, but using just wildlife dollars for wildlife programs or fisheries dollars for fisheries programs will cause some budget gaps in those activities if we just kept them purely based on the type of license that was sold. So while fund integrity is very important to us, and it's something we strive for in everything we do, this Game and Fish Fund imbalance that some people refer to is something we don't have our hands on right now. We're trying to figure it out. This is the first step, be it a small step probably, but we're working with the Budget Oversight Committee to try to figure out solutions, present solutions to them. It's on our agenda for next Tuesday night, 5:30 over in the DNR building, if you're willing or interested in coming over. Discuss the issue with the members and ourselves. So I just wanted to make sure you were aware of that we are trying to work on some solutions, that we do take the issue very seriously.
Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Meyer, I'm just following up on the fishing tournament so I can get a better idea of what these are. I mean, are these some of these, like a local Lions Club, just doing a fundraiser for a project, or are most of these, you know, well-publicized, shall we say, not poor people participating in them?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, the small kind of club tournaments with a small number of anglers generally don't require permits. We've got tournaments of various sizes that are occurring in the state, and what we've seen here are the larger tournaments, the ones that do require permits. The number of those has increased quite a bit. They back in 1995, it was about 275 of those permits were being issued. In 2005, that was close to 600. So we're seeing a lot more of these larger tournaments, and with that, our costs in issuing those permits and monitoring the tournaments and that kind of thing have gone up, and that's the reason for the concern by this Budget Oversight Committee and their recommendation that the tournaments should pay for themselves, that licensed buyers, that anglers shouldn't subsidize the cost of overseeing these permitted activities. The small tournaments that don't require permits, they're not resulting in any cost to our programs, and so they would not be included in this fee proposal.
Representative Jody.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Meyer, you made reference to a statute 16A that says you can't make a profit. I'm not familiar with that at all. Is that specific only to these tournaments, or is that a broad prohibition that you work under in the DNR?
Madam Chair, Representative Doty, thank you for the clarification. 16A, I believe it's point 1285 and 1283, provide requirements not only to the DNR, but all executive branch agencies, that they cannot overcharge or undercharge for the services, but charge the actual price of doing the business. It does have some exemptions to it, but we follow those statutes very closely when we do our permitting activities and all of our kind of regulatory functions as well. So it's not just for the DNR, it's for every state agency. Thank you.
Representative Wall, I believe you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment. I know there's a tension with the DNR a little bit, too, on fishing tournaments. I mean, there are huge economic drivers in northern Minnesota, and not all of the anglers are very well-to-do. In fact, some of them are real so hardcore they don't have much of a place to live or a car, but they got a great boat. So I guess from the other side, there's, at least for myself, there's some sympathy towards the trying to keep those fees reasonable so we actually can make the entrance to those tournaments affordable for people who don't have great means, but they still come up and stay in our hotels and resorts, and you get a picture. Thanks.
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, just for clarification, this is for the actual overall permit that the organizers would come in and apply for. It's not the individual one. So.
Yeah, Madam Chair, but they still have to charge, and that organization is responsible for charging the entrance fee to the tournament system.
I'm sure you're absolutely correct.
Do you want to continue?
Thank you. The next change item we have in the budget is the Roadsides for Wildlife program. It says Roadsides Habitat here. This is the Roadsides for Wildlife program. This program was funded with one-time dollars last biennium. What we're looking for here is to fund this program with $100,000 from the Game and Fish Fund. This has been recommended by our Budget Oversight Committee. You can see underneath the slide there, Roadsides can produce 25 to 50% of the pheasant chicks in the state. They are a critical habitat for nesting birds and migratory birds to find habitat to nest and then to grow in those areas. What this does, this program provides technical assistance to road authorities and citizens to increase the public awareness of these roadsides and their ability to produce habitat. We've also reinstituted or reinvigorated, I should say, our education program about when these roadsides should be mowed and how to mow them at a certain time of year. Also making sure people realize the benefits of increasing the use of native prairie grasses and wildflowers. talk about the reduced spraying of herbicides and some of those contacts, what they can do to the wildlife, and instead of maybe an overall treatment, do a spot treatment where needed. And also, again, talking about mowing, reduce roadside haying before July 31st. Some of these changes were actually put in statute in this bill. There are some concerns about the safety, roadsides, visibility, things like that, but working with the public road authorities directly is where we can resolve these issues, doing education, letting them see the benefits. It's been a very successful program. We want to continue that. The roadsides habitat, I'm just trying to see if I have it in my notes, it produces miles and, you know, Minnesota's roadsides could provide more than 525,000 acres of permanent, well-distributed wildlife habitat within the Pheasant Range. So if you just think of that, even though it's linear, that is a huge area for us to improve our conservation and habitat, and also direct water quality into these drainage systems that are out there. So we recognize the value and want to continue doing this program.
I'm glad you're recognizing the value and want to do it. Let me just tell you a tiny little story that still concerns me. In Douglas County, or in Solem Township, where we have our farm, folks are paid to spray the roadsides by the gallon. And is that practice still part of what is taught by MnDOT to townships?
Madam Chair, that's actually one of the issues that we'd like to work more with these road authorities on. There are alternatives to that broadcast spraying for weeds that are less damaging to the grass, the habitat, and the wildlife. Also, spot spraying, for example, trying to focus not on killing weeds, but on reducing the chances of those weeds occurring the following year. So part of our effort here in getting into a roadside program is to do the educational work to talk to the MnDOT road maintenance folks, to talk to the county and the local road authorities, and try to inform them about some of these alternatives. They get together for conferences just like everybody else. There are great opportunities for us to kind of get the word out and do some education. But it takes a body to do that, and that's what we'd like hope to do with this initiative.
I think it's a terrific initiative. I mean, I've had so much problem with roadside spraying for things I've actually intentionally planted that were supposed to be wind breaks sprayed out, watching them go through and spraying native prairie. Will you be having someone at these conferences who could teach prairie identification?
Madam Chair,
not stuff that we have to replant, but out there that's being sprayed.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that's one of the real major focuses of our program here, is trying to shift the seeding that some of these road authorities are using from non-native plants to native plants, and there are habitat benefits to use of native plants, native prairie plants. There's also lower maintenance costs because, as you say, they don't have to be replanted, and management of those of that cover is cheaper, actually.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up, part of my concern with the roadside habitat may not necessarily be the spraying or the planting, but the plowing. It's hard to have the habitat when it's converted to cropland. And you can drive along certain roads and you see the creep between the telephone lines where the plow line comes in between. And your representative Gunther's area, where my brother farms, we had a neighbor on a township, and the township sent him letters saying, don't do it. And what it finally took is the township going out there and planting the right-of-way rod one rod apart along the field. And that's what it took. So they couldn't go between the rods. And that's what finally stopped plowing the road edge. And I think just anecdotally, when you drive around, when the price of commodities goes up, you might see more plowing this spring into those road ditches, which could you maybe just tell me what the right-of-way is on a public road and whether that can be cropped or not?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that's a complicated answer, actually. There's a combination of rights-of-ways out there. In some cases, they are purchased in fee title so that the road authority actually owns the land out to a certain right-of-way, and depending on the type of road, it could be 33, 66, however many feet wide. In many cases, it's only an easement to build the road and maintain the road. The landowner continues to own the underlying property, and in that case can continue plant it and do other things. We actually undertook a project a number of years ago. We haven't been able to bring it to completion. In fact, it's something we hope to do with our roadside program here, where we actually went out and searched land records, and we've got several big boxes of these land records that we'd like to put into a digital format, so we could actually, on any piece of right-of-way, we could determine whether or not it was a fee title or easement right-of-way in case we wanted to enforce things like cropping, haying, that kind of thing. Without having that knowledge of who owns the right-of-way, it's very, very difficult to enforce existing law.
Just follow up. I'm glad to hear that you've got the data to do that, because then the decision is based on fact rather than assumption. So just to clarify, you have that data for certain regions, or do you have that data statewide for the road system? For the state road system, not the townships? Or
you know, Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I believe it's for state highways and county state aid highways, but I'm not absolutely certain. I'll get back to you with that.
You want to continue?
Madam Chair, the next slide here, slide 22, focuses on our request for statutory appropriations for Fish and Wildlife appropriations. You can see what we're looking for here, and it's, again, working with the Budget Oversight Committee, moving forward some of their recommendations. We're looking for the ability to access the dedicated accounts or appropriations for seven dedicated accounts or funds within the Game and Fish Fund to be changed to statutory appropriations. These include the Deer Bear Management and Computerized Licensing Account, 978.075 sub 1C. You can, I have all the statute sites there for you. The Deer Habitat Improvement Account, Trout and Salmon Management, Pheasant Habitat Improvement, Wildlife Acquisition, and Wild Turkey Priority Management. What we want to do is increase the efficiencies of these fund allocations. Many times, or often, they are left with balances on the books that we have to wait for the next biennium to access. A perfect example is this year we sold a record number of pheasant stands. That money is in the account, and we're waiting to have it expended. All of our work, or most of our work, related to those accounts. The pheasant stamp account, for example, the statutes say money in the account may be used only for development, restoration, and maintenance of suitable habitat for ringneck pheasants, reimbursement of landowners for setting aside lands for pheasant habitat, reimbursement of expenditures to provide pheasant habitat on public and private land, the promotion of pheasant habitat, and the acquisition of lands. Many of these activities have to take place in the spring during the planting season, or working with farmers and landowners before they make management decisions that they're doing right now. Without the ability to access the balance in those funds, we are reducing our habitat and conservation efforts on the field. These have specific statutory authority. They're overseen. These expenses are overseen directly by the Budget Oversight Committee, who are, as you know or will know, a very dedicated group of individuals who are not afraid of bringing issues to the forefront and bringing them to the legislature. We feel with that overview and the need for the spending on the ground, this only makes sense for us right now. To get at some of these dollars that we have, we can't overspend the accounts by any means, and they do have specific authority. So what we're asking for you is a little faith in us and our Budget Oversight Committee to get the work done that we need to as fast as we can on the ground. The last one that we have deals with the DNR budget reallocation that we spoke of in the very beginning of this process as we went through and identified costs in forestry that could be charged or should be being charged to the forest manager investment account. That freed up a little bit over $3 million of general fund in our budgets that we reallocated internally. Several of those pieces you'll see here, we wanted to shift our treaty costs from the Game and Fish Fund to the general fund. Again, Budget Oversight Committee members thought that the Game and Fish Fund was subsidizing these costs, and they preferred to have those funded out of the general fund as it is a general state issue. People throughout the state are benefiting, not just people from the Game and Fish, because they focus on all sorts of treaty-related issues. Also, the South Metro Wildlife, $128,000, is to increase the funding needed to do the enforcement and the work activities down in the Umore area. That Representative McNamara has a bill with us, helping us to formalize the designation of those properties that were transferred or are in the process of being transferred to us for management in the Rosemount area. And also $90,000 to increase and enhance our Game and Fish Fund oversight. This is for our costs directly related to the Budget Oversight Committee, providing them with more staffing, more ability to get the reports out and things like that they need to do. So those are what we're looking to do with that general fund budget reallocation piece. And then if there's no questions on that, Madam Chair, this next slide shows you the Game and Fish Fund, or Fish and Wildlife budget, I should say, with the proposed governor's recommendations. The total would be $176.7 million, with about 75% of that coming from the Game and Fish Fund, $7.4 million or 4.2% from the general fund, and then the general fund treaty payments, about 9% of that budget, which is $15.7 million. On the last table here, you can see it shows the current spending on top, general fund, other funds, total $167,438,000 for this biennium. And then on the bottom, you can see the new total for FY08-09 would be $176,706,000, or a difference of about $9,300,000 or so, with $153,643 coming from other funds, largely Game and Fish Fund accounts, and the general funding, $23,063,000 coming from general fund.
I have a question on here. I noted in some of the other accounts where you're losing folks, FTEs. I didn't note the FTEs, and I maybe just missed it when I was reading this. At the end of the biennium, will you have lost FTEs or gained them in this area?
Madam Chair, I think we're going to have to get back to you on that question.
Thank you.
Do we have any other questions for the Fish and Wildlife Division? If not, I'd like to move on to the Enforcement Division. I think we can get through that one in a relatively, I don't want to say short time, but relatively quickly, and then hopefully we can start the forestry presentation, and we can continue that tonight, wrap up at a halfway decent hour. Madam Chair, members, you should have in your book the DNR Enforcement Presentation. If you don't, we have available copies up front here. And with that, I'd like to introduce Colonel Mike Hamm, Director of our Enforcement Office, or Enforcement. He's the state's Chief Conservation Officer.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Colonel Mike Hamm, Chief Conservation Officer with the Division of Enforcement, the Department of Natural Resources. You'll notice on this slide that it gives the enforcement 06-07 expenditure budget quick overview, where you can see our total appropriations, whether they're direct or statutory, are $61.2 million, And of that, we have, as an example, $37.6 million from the Game and Fish Fund, $14.2 million from the Natural Resources Fund, $6.8 million from the General Fund, and then federal, which is actually our recreational boating safety, $1.9 million, and Environment Natural Resources, $0.4 million, and the numbers move on. I would also like to quickly say thank you to this committee and for the work that you have done over the last couple of bienniums. We had a Conservation Officer Academy that started Wednesday, just a couple of Wednesdays ago, of 18 conservation officers, and that will bring us up to what we consider a full complement. And so all of our field stations and, in fact, all of our conservation officer jobs are now what we would consider at full staff, although 18 of them are in the academy moving through. We do have another anticipated retirement over the course of fiscal year 08 and fiscal year 09, but through your help and the legislature help and the governor's office, we've been able to now get on top of that, and it is very much appreciated.
Before you go on, why don't you let us know how many people of color were able to be included in this academy?
Madam Chair, the question again is how many people
of color?
Madam Chair and members, there are none. There are 18 white males in this particular academy. The academy that we had started 4 years ago was 14 white males and 4 females. And then 3 years ago, it was 15 males and 3 females. And then 2 years ago, it was 16 white males with 2 females. And then last year, it was 15 white males, one of Cuban background and a white female. And this one is all 18 white males.
This is not a good trend line.
Well, Madam Chair and members, we do have about very close to 10% of our conservation officer workforce. 20 of the 205 are females, and we do have a recruitment program out there where we are actively pursuing getting into the communities. I don't know exactly why the trend was going the opposite direction 4 years ago. I was pretty excited about those types of numbers, and we work on it. We go to the schools that are out there. We advertise through the post board with other peace officers to make them aware of the opportunities that are in the natural resources field, and we just do believe that it is important to continue to work in that direction, Madam Chair.
Representative Benford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don't you think it should somewhat mirror the population of the state as far as who we recruit for these positions? And do we have any, do we go to any effort at all to get people of color, minorities that will match the districts that you put them in or something like that?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Gunther, we do look at that, but it's not so much the general population as it might be the population that is involved in the natural resources that are out there. We do have conservation officers that are American Indians. We have a conservation officer that is of Hmong, one that is Cambodian, and one that is Vietnamese. So we have a fairly good balance of what is out there for the general population that is involved in the outdoor experience. But certainly we could do better and continue to strive to do better.
Follow up.
Yes,
thank you, Madam Chair. I look at the area that I live in, and I fish an awful lot. I'm a shore fisherman, so I see a lot of people. Good way to
campaign, by the way. But in my area, we have a rather large Hispanic population. And to be real honest with you, they violate most of the laws that I see violated. And I can't think of a better way to address that than to get a Latino for a conservation officer. I think that person would certainly have command more immediate respect, and people would listen to him.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative, I don't doubt that, and we are continuing to work in that direction for recruitment out there.
I'm a little bit troubled when you say that that you think you reflect the folks who are participating in the outdoor experience. I suspect there are quite a few more women proportionately than you are crediting. This is something we probably need to have some more discussion about later. If you want to go on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You'll notice on this slide the DNR enforcement core functions, which, again, are protecting our natural resources and public safety through quality education and law enforcement. We have the game and fish is a big portion of our the enforcement type work that we do. Resource protection, of course, the recreational enforcement, whether it's ATVs, snowmobiles, off-highway motorcycles, watercraft. The safety training education program, which is the snowmobile and firearm safety programs designed for our youth that are out there, and ATV training as well. We do have some adult components, clinics and opportunities out there for bear hunting, turkey hunting, big game, waterfall components for adults as well. And then also the public safety and service. We have in 2005 we have trained more than 45,000 citizens through these education programs. We have had about in Minnesota 277,000 registered snowmobiles, and for ATVs, off-road vehicles, and off-highway motorcycles, we're in the over 260,000. Our watercraft are numbering 853,000, still a very high percentage across the United States. And our hunting licenses, are, including the stamps, are in the 860,000 range, and our fishing licenses are 1.5 million. Again, we have 154 conservation officers that are assigned to specific field stations out there for field duties. We have an aviation unit, conservation officer pilots. We have used those for all kinds of outdoor recreation, natural resources, enforcement, aerial census mapping. We also have wetland enforcement officers that are designed specifically to deal with the type of wetland issues that we have out there, and our training and standards with which works to our academy and getting our new officers field ready, as well as training existing conservation officers for the post-board requirements. Our priority outcomes and measures are Minnesota's natural resources are protected and conserved. You can see in this particular slide that shows the number of warnings and summons and what the totals are. The warnings are in the blue, the summons are in the red color, and then the total is in the so you can see the fish category or the game category. We just pulled out a handful plus of categories. Again, one of our main outcomes of the enforcement division is to see that that Minnesota's natural resources are protected and conserved. Clearly, we know that our work in enforcement is also education focused, and that we need to primarily affect the people's behavior out there to develop and ensure a stewardship of our natural resources. And that that becomes very clear with wetland type enforcement work. Again, we're focusing on those categories in the slide. We do about 26,000 violations documented annually, and this particular graph is for fiscal year 06.
if you could help me out here, I'm sure other folks know. I understand what a warning is. What is the consequence of the summons?
The summons, Madam Chair and members, the summons is the ticket, is the citation. Is they can either take care of that. The court system allows for somebody who is issued a ticket to either pay it off of the statewide fine schedule that has been established by the court system, or they may appear in court in front of a judge. That's what the summons would be. It's a violation, Madam Chair.
Okay, I understand it's a violation. We are worried about some of the consequences of, like, invasives going from one lake to another. So we see that high, and we see this on the other hand, and I'm trying to figure out if the consequences are such that they are a prevention. And that's the issue I'm trying to get to here.
And Madam Chair and members, we do work with the court system, who does establish all the statewide fines for all violations, not just natural resources. And we share with them the information and some of the trends or some of the concerns that we might have, so that they have a better understanding. And if they want to raise that particular fine again, it is up to the court system and the process that's used, but we at least try to give them information that we have, and invasive species and the movement of the invasive species could certainly be a component of that, Madam Chair.
In your judgment, does our system of fines mean that someone who is fined will not do that again because they do not want to be fined again? Or do our fines not discourage bad behavior?
Well, Madam Chair and members, that is an excellent question, because the court system and the criminal justice system deals with that just in society as a whole. Clearly, there are times that we do see that it does work. Not all that many years ago, this legislative body instituted the gross over limits legislation, in which somebody that was really abusing the resource over limits would lose all of the equipment and their licenses that are involved. What we have seen in the Game and Fish, Madam Chair and members, is Minnesota is a part of a nationwide compact, of which I think there's 24 or 25 states for violation and revocation of fishing and hunting licenses. It's patterned along the same principle as driver's licenses are across the country. And clearly we have seen that people who hunt and fish don't want to lose the right to hunt and fish for any length of time. And so that does have that, clearly that does have that impact.
The issues that seem to be under discussion the most, and I know certainly in a bipartisan fashion, are invasives and the transporting of invasives. That's one. And the protection of wetlands, because we're all concerned about ducks. Do the courts understand in setting fines for moving invasive species around? Are those fines sufficient to discourage that behavior from happening again?
Well, Madam Chair and members, I think that the court is getting a better understanding of that situation. Clearly, as the invasive species is moving out into rural areas and dealing with the rural court system, sometimes can be a little bit easier. I don't know the answer to the question about whether the fine dollar amount is enough. I don't know yet. I don't know if that's having. I do know that we don't have the repeat offenders in the invasive species like we might in some of the other situations that we're involved with. But that could be because it's as simply as remembering to get out and pull the plug on draining the live well and doing the quick inspection for the weed. Could be something as simple as that. Madam Chair and members, moving on, the next slide talks about priority outcomes and measures for recreational safety through education and enforcement. And again, I had mentioned that we do the firearms safety program, the advanced hunter ed, the snowmobile safety, the all-terrain vehicle, and of course our information and education section does the watercraft safety training. We are typically training right around 24,000 students in firearm safety and about 3,000 students in the advanced hunter ed. Our all-terrain vehicle safety is about 3,500 and our snowmobile is just under 15,000. Again, the firearm safety program not only teaches the safe use of firearm safety handling, but it also talks about hunter education and the hunter ethics and game laws and wildlife identification is specifically written into the law for us to address, and we also touch on wildlife management. So although the program started in 1955 and it started out as a firearms safety training program, and the name still remains the same, it is far more than just firearm safety.
Representative Hoffman has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colonel Hamm, and I think I already know the answer to this, but I have a constituent who wanted me to ask you. He has a 10-year-old who has been with him hunting for several years, and he's a very mature 10-year-old. He can't take, legally, he cannot take the firearm safety training until he turns 11, and it doesn't take effect until he's 12. He's wondering if there's any way a 10-year-old could take that and still not have it apply until they turn 12. And I think that the answer is, what I told him is, for 99.9% of kids, there's a big maturity jump between 10 and 12, and that's the reason for it. But is there any reason why we couldn't have 10-year-olds, if they're mature, take it, even though it still wouldn't be legal until they turn 12? So if you have a kid that, you know, where his birthday would be kind of halfway through, so instead of waiting until he turns 11 and then waiting for the season to come around and make it legal anyhow, could they do it as 10-year-olds, or is this just a hideously bad idea?
Madam Chair and Representative Hoppe, right at the tail end where you said that this could be a bad idea.
I said hideously bad. That's what I thought.
That's correct. It is a maturity level, Madam Chair and members, and we do have instructors. We see even the difference, and I have taught the course as well. We see even the difference between 11-year-olds and those that are 11 and a half. We can tell the difference. But also it's important to remember that this 10-year-old can still go out hunting with mom, dad, aunt, uncle, anybody that is an adult. And the only species, of course, that they can't hunt is the big game species, but they can do the pheasants, the grouse, the rabbits, the squirrels, the waterfowl. So they can continue to be actively involved in that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Colonel.
Moving on to our next slide, the critical trend in increasing enforcement needs, and in this particular slide you'll see wetland protection, and that is one of the department's aircraft being flown by a conservation officer. In 2005, we started a special effort to do some identification and locate some wetland destruction in southern Minnesota. And then in 2006, the division and the department decided to expand that geographic coverage. And of course, our educational work and our media work, we do a vast amount of media releases on these particular situations. And conservation officer pilots and, again, our wetland enforcement officers, and we have six of them, patrolled targeted areas with aircraft. And there were conservation officers on the ground working with these teams to do follow-ups. And as you can see on our outcomes, we had 542 possible impacts. Now, that's possible impacts that were recognized from the air. At this point, we don't know if they are permitted or not, but because it's obvious from the air to be able to see some of these situations, we then have to do follow-up and conservation officers on the ground in to find out if they were permitted or not. 316 of those 542 were verified impacts to wetlands, protected waters, or aquatic plant management, because we were also looking at weed rollers or also maybe harvesting of other vegetation. Again, of the 316, 148 were violations where some type of enforcement action was taken, whether it was a warning that was out there or whether it was a summons, but we did take enforcement action. Also, because of this, these 542 checks, we still have 77 that are still under investigation. But it did gain great public awareness. I'm sure some of you saw the spread that was in the various Twin Cities papers on it, and we think that Minnesota is a leader in this type of enforcement, and it's because the legislature makes it a priority, which then means conservation officers can, and other peace officers can, take enforcement action out there. And it's really the credit goes to both the House and the Senate and the body saying that it's important enough that we have to do something about wetland protection.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My last question went so well, I thought I'd try another one. And Colonel Hammock, you addressed this. I missed it, and I apologize. But when you're doing the aerial, I don't know what word to use, but do you do that for deer hunting? Does that cover looking at people that are baiting for deer, where you can see a bait pile and stands and things from there?
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, we do. We use it for we use aerial surveillance for a lot of different types of outdoor game and fish and or recreational observations, and we do use it for not only deer baiting but also for waterfall baiting. And we have noticed that the trend is on the way up on deer baiting over the course of the last few years. And but it is a very, very effective tool for law enforcement.
Thank you.
I'm looking at the 148 violations with enforcement action. By enforcement action, do you mean the wetlands be restored?
Madam Chair and members, it more than likely it means that either aquatic vegetation without a permit was illegally harvested or removed, or yes, there were wetlands, whether they were a wetland conservation officer wetland or Conservation Act wetlands or public waters, that there was damage. And Madam Chair and members, in that case, then the conservation officer starts working with the local government unit or whatever agency needs to be done for restoration and restoration orders. But it could mean that, Madam Chair, yes.
I am concerned about, from your point on, enforcement, not your finding and you're saying, here's a violation, here's an order. But if I understand correctly, you are relying on local county attorneys, is that it? Or can you just do the orders yourself and that's it?
Madam Chair and members, the county attorney's office is not involved in this particular process. Okay. It's working with local government units and tech panels and Bowser and the Division of Waters, all depending upon whether it's a wetland violation or a public waters type violation. There may come a time where everything we have tried is not working, and then we need to step into the arena of the county attorneys. And there have even been cases where we needed to work with the county attorneys to work with the judges so that it's a court-ordered restoration. That's not real common, Madam Chair and members, but it does happen.
Do Do you feel like you do not have the tool of an administrative penalty order, is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Would that be a tool that would be useful for you in doing what needs to be done?
Madam Chair and members, we certainly could take a look at that. I don't know the answer to that today.
I would think it would be something worthwhile to look at, because then you don't have the process is so much easier and so much less expensive. And I mean, it seems that you have part of what would be an administrative penalty order, but not the whole thing. And that's my understanding, and it may be very weak understanding, but it would be interesting to know from you if having the kind of administrative penalty orders that everybody else has that make something not a criminal action, which I think we want to avoid having to go to criminal courts on these things, that's not a good idea. We want things to get back to the way they were without criminalizing anybody. So it would be interesting if you would give us some feedback on that.
Madam Chair, members, it is something that we have explored in the past. We've had a bill in the past several years to do that. It's met a lot of opposition, but we can talk more about what we were proposing and what we ran into.
Well, let us have a chat about that, because making people criminals is not always in the best interest of anybody, and so many of our laws, and I think these seem to lead in that direction as the finality of it as a criminal action, isn't it?
Madam Chair and members, you're correct. It's a misdemeanor violation.
And criminal actions are not necessarily the best way to get a wetland restored, which is what we want. The outcome is not to make somebody a criminal, but to get the wetland fixed back. I would think that that's something where we would have a pretty... everybody would agree with that.
We'll check into that, Madam Chair.
That would be helpful.
Moving on to the budget issues regarding the Division of Enforcement, there are two legislative initiatives we're looking for change on this session. The first one you can see deals with the DNR budget reallocation process. As Colonel Hamm spoke, we are very happy to, for the first time in many years, have a full complement of officers, of agents in the conservation field, in our field staff. We need to do another academy. We need to continue our academy training, because we're facing more retirements coming up. If we don't keep up on this, we'll be down 10, 15 more officers in the blink of an eye. So we need to continue those activities. It is time-consuming. However, Colonel Hamm and his staff have kind of perfected what they feel is the best way to train these officers with a small academy. We do most of the training in-house up at Camp Ripley, so we divert time and effort to training these folks, bring them into the field. But it is the best way to really give them a grounded basis to get out and do the work we need to change that behavior and enforce that behavior change. The other piece, this is just a slide here that shows our vacancies right now. We're at zero. Next year we're projecting 8 or 9, I should say. Following year, 6. And those are based on what we know, retirements that we know out there. There most likely will be more, so we need to keep up on that. The other change item deals with the ATV all-terrain vehicle gas tax bill that's been introduced. Both Representative Doty and Representative Hackbarth have bills on this issue. We're working for increasing the ATV gas tax percentage of the underfunded gas tax program from 0.15% to 0.27%. The first time, the 0.15% is based on 12,008 registered ATVs done in the mid-80s. Currently, we have about 240,000 registered ATVs out there, and the amount of gas that they use, we've estimated to be about 30 gallons or so per machine. We've done a study working with our stakeholders, MnDOT and other folks, to determine what kind of gas usage those folks are using on an annual basis, and then attributed it back, similar to what we do with boats snowmobiles, other unrefunded gas tax programs that are out there. So what this will amount to is a change of about $630,000 per year, which we want to allocate through three different programs. Our Grant and Aid Trail System, we want to provide increased funding of $215,000 in 08 and $307,000 in 09. You can see this on the fact sheets on page 13. Also, we need the Off-Highway Vehicle Safety Grant and Safety and Conservation Grant Program, providing money into education and training for individuals. We're looking at in 08, providing $50,000 increased funding to that, and then in 09, $225,000. And then the maintenance of minimum maintenance forest roads within county and state forest roads, county and state boundaries, we need to make sure that we're maintaining those appropriately. We're proposing to put $50,000 in 08 and $100,000 in 09 into those activities as well. The goals that we have with this program is to improve safety and responsibility of riders and reduce environmental impacts on state forest land and other public lands, and also provide increased assistance and oversight for all new and existing ATV grant and aid trail projects. Also, increased funding for the trail projects will provide more ability or greater staffing or allow us to provide compliance with environmental review and protection regulations, making sure that these trail systems are designed where they're supposed to be and in a manner that will provide sustainable and safe recreational use. Madam Chair, this next slide on page 10, slide 10, will shows you the operations of the Enforcement Division's budget for FY08-09, total of $64.8 million, a large portion of that coming from the Game and Fish Fund, 22-23% from Natural Resources Fund, a small piece of federal funds, and then you can see about 11% or $7 million from the general fund. And just in summary, Madam Chair and members, on slide 11, you'll see FY06 current spending at $61,323,000. We're proposing the enforcement budget for the total 08-09 biennium to be increased to $64,807,000. Of that, $7,128,000 from the general fund, and $57,679,000 from other funds. This does include a compensation adjustment and a maintenance of service adjustment as well to help us deal with the increasing salary costs and staffing costs that all agencies are facing.
In your case, there is no change in, essentially no change in FTEs. We have the expectation that we will have greater enforcement, particularly in the area of wetlands and invasives. Am I correct about that?
Madam Chair and members, that would be correct because all of our field stations would finally be filled with conservation officers.
In addition, Madam Chair, the invasives program, the change item that we discussed, does involve the hiring of, I think, two more conservation officers to help us deal with the invasive species specific issues as well. So we're trying to where we can obtain new dollars, and we need to increase enforcement activities to do so with those dollars.
Representative Ansel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell us, on an annual basis, give us a snapshot of what it costs to fully equip a conservation officer?
Madam Chair and members, it's right in the neighborhood of $114,000.
Follow-up, Madam Chair? It's my experience that the job of the conservation officer over the last 25 years has just exploded. I see conservation officers at ATV meetings in the evenings and in the weekends. I see conservation officers with the snowmobile people, organized groups of mushroom harvesters and everything else. And I just would like the committee to focus just for a little bit on the expanded responsibilities of these people and the activities that we ask them to regulate and the scope of the job. One more comment going back to the gender issue, Madam Chair, if I could. I have visited the law enforcement programs at the community colleges, and I've talked to young men and women about law enforcement and why it is they're interested and where they want to be. And unfortunately, Madam Chair, conservation officer is at the bottom of the list of what young women are looking at in terms of where they want to be in terms of their career. So that might explain the gender imbalance a little bit. It's a difficult, challenging law enforcement profession, being a conservation officer, and that may partially explain the imbalance between men and women on the force. Enough said.
Well, let me ask another question. When I look at some of the issues that the Minneapolis police force has had, and it seems that you can get people from the law enforcement academies like Alexandria, or you can get somebody with a biology background and has a degree, a BS in biology, and train them in the law enforcement part. You can go either way. Do you go both ways? Do you take people who have just come out of law enforcement and then pick up the wildlife that they need, or do you take people who have the wildlife and pick up the law enforcement? I've simplified that, but...
Madam Chair and members, they are required, applicants are required to have the basic law enforcement training. We are a fully fledged law enforcement agency, and so they do come to us having the education component of law enforcement, and it is a wide variety. We do have candidates that come to us that have their major is in biology and their minor is in law enforcement and or criminal justice. We are starting to find a trend that we're getting more four-year degree type applicants, and in fact with the four-year degree we're starting to see more of a, whether it's a recreational component or whether it's a biology background, we're starting to see that out of the four-year components. Because if you're trying to get a job or land a job as a conservation officer and you only want to go to school for the 2 years, it's mandatory to have that criminal justice or that law enforcement background. But we are seeing more and more of that.
It seems to me that what Minneapolis did, and I have to go back and look, but is they took people with four-year degrees in other things. It wouldn't have been biology, but for your purposes, 4 years degree gives some folks a certain amount of more maturity. I mean, you recognize those kids from 10 to 12, it's the same thing for a young person. That extra 2 years of maturity is a lot. And they provided the law enforcement training. Is that something you all have ever looked into, get waivers so you can provide the law enforcement training for somebody who has a four-year degree and a background in the sciences that would be useful to you?
Madam Chair and members, we have not looked at that in the last 4 years, and in fact, since POST became mandated back in 1980 or 1981, we have not, as a division, looked at that either. I do know that Minneapolis has looked at that. I do know that the State Patrol has had some small academies that that they have looked at as well. We feel that the type of candidate that we're getting is still a quality type candidate that does have a natural resources background and an interest. They know that they're going to be stepping into an arena of more than likely a rural area, and clearly they know that they're going to be stepping into an arena that they're working alone. There aren't any two-officer, conservation officer assigned cars. Now, certainly they do work together, but their stations are not assigned that direction.
I don't have any doubt that you have super candidates, but I do have real doubts because you don't have women or people of color. That seems to me, and I almost hate to say it on the record, but it seems to me that leaves us very liable in a way that I don't, and I'm not comfortable with. Well, enough said on that. Any other questions from members? I didn't call a quorum. We do have quorum. So in that, I will formally call the meeting to order, and I think you're finished with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And call for recess until this evening at 6:30. We will reconvene. Welcome back. And do you want to introduce your...
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. I have with me Bob Tomlinson, our Assistant Director for Forestry. Unfortunately, David Epperly, our Director, is unable to be here tonight. You should have in your packets before you a presentation titled FY 2008-2009 Budgeting for Results, DNR Forestry. That's what we'll be working through here, going through, as we have in the past, some of the core functions, priority outcomes, and critical trends, and then cover the change items and answer any questions that you have. Madam Chair, I do have several of the information items you asked of me yesterday related to forestry. I don't know if you want me to hand those out.
I think
or
that would be helpful.
Through them out at a different time. Or?
I think members, one of the things I had said to Mr. Meyer, that as I read the budgeting for results DNR forestry, I was having a difficulty finding the outcomes, and so asked if we could see their budget for the past 2 years so we knew we would have a better idea of the outcomes without having to go through a whole other slideshow. So that is, I think, probably one of the things he is giving to us. And
yep, yes. Madam Chair, you'll be receiving a pie chart, two pie charts, actually. One is the 07 current spending we have right now, and the next one is the 08 appropriations. I apologize, this could have been done 06, 07, and 08, 09, but we're just looking at 07 and 08 here. Looking at percentages, I do have the numbers if you wanted to write them down for what those percentages are. I could run through those relatively quickly for you if you're interested. And the other piece deals with forest management building blocks, it's titled. These are the actual activities that are covered under these different pieces: fire suppression, fire preparedness, timber management, forest development, state land asset support. CFM is cooperative forest management, and also the fire prevention and core program support. You can see the relative percentages based upon that 32.6 in 07 and also the 38.8 million is what we're seeking for FY fiscal year 08 for forestry.
Why don't you begin, and this will give members some more basis for asking questions, and I'm sure they'll take the opportunity.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Tomlinson. I'm the Assistant Director with the DNR Division of Forestry. I guess we should start then perhaps with slide 2 in the handouts that you originally received, which is basically the slide that shows the DNR Forestry expenditures for our budget for 06 and 07 fiscal year. And I'll just make a couple of comments on.
Well, if you don't mind, help me out why the total of 127 on slide 2 and 117 is on slide 25. I didn't understand why they would be different. In all your other slides, they were the same.
Slide 5.
The last slide.
Madam Chair, you're referring to the fiscal year 06 or 07 compared to fiscal year 08 or 09, correct?
Right. The current
Madam Chair, the pie chart on slide 2 includes one-time money that was carried forward. That was not shown in the slide back on page, or on the table on page 26, I think, is what you were referring to. Why there's a difference there?
So you're saying that 117 is the base?
That's correct, Madam Chair. So with slide number 2, it shows that the total expenditures for the 06-07 biennium are $127 million for the Division of Forestry in DNR. The general fund is $67.4 million, or 53%. And I would just remind folks that I believe back, I think it was 2003, before we set up the Forest Management Investment Account, the general fund actually represented about 95% of the Division of Forestry's appropriation back then. So with the advent of the Forest Management Investment Account, we're spending much less general fund and more dedicated funding within the DNR Division of Forestry. The general fund, $67.4 million, includes $31.9 million for fire. $17.5 million of that is out of the open appropriation. And the direct is $14.4 million, which is the appropriation that comes to us in the direct appropriation. And then on top of that, you have forest management funding, which is $35.4 million. So that those items add up to the $67.4 that makes up the general fund appropriation for the 06-07 biennium. Then the special revenue is $23.9 million total. $8.7 million of that is fire. And the balance is forest management, including payments through the FMIA for the consolidated conservation lands, or the CONCON lands, State Forest Road gas account, and some miscellaneous smaller accounts that total up to that, bring that total up to $23.9 million for the 06-07 biennium. The natural resources fund was $20.8 million. That's the forest management investment account, which was about $10.4 million per year. I think it was actually $10.375 rounded up thereabouts, that we were appropriated each year in the last biennium, in the current biennium. And then for federal, we have $11.7 million there, of which fire reimbursements for out-state fire, off-state fire fighting responsibilities and the like, it totals up to $3.8 million. And then Forest Legacy is in at $3.8 million. That's the federal Forest Legacy program, which was meant to complement, of course, the LCMR appropriations that we've got in the current biennium. And then the Forest Health is in there at $1 million, and Forest Stewardship for Private Land Management is in there at $800,000 or $400,000 a year for writing stewardship plans and helping landowners implement the practices in those plans. We also received $2.6 million out of the Environment and Natural Resources Fund, being LCMR, and we had Game and Fish of about $500,000, $250,000 a year, which was basically used by the division for ECS development of the ecological classification system and implementation, the beginning stages, I guess I would say, of the implementation of that, which you'll hear more about as we're discussing our change level items here further on in the presentation. So those things total up to the $127 million and how we and the dollars that we operated on the Division of Forestry for the 06-07 biennium that we're currently in. Moving on to slide number 3, the core functions there, again, what we're doing with those fundings there to protect 45.5 million acres of land in Minnesota from wildfires. We're offering for sale about 750,000 to 800,000 cords of wood each year. which, by the way, is enough to, as they say here, it's enough to build about 15,000 homes. We are also producing 8 to 10 million tree seedlings out of our state forest nurseries for planting on public and private lands. We reforest 30,000 acres of state forest lands each year. About half of that is a little over half of that is natural regen, where we have to take care with our silvicultural prescriptions and certain expectations with the loggers to do certain things to provide for that reforestation to come in. The balance of it is about 12 or 13,000 acres of that is artificially regenerated with tree planting and seeding on those sites. And then we also provide technical and cost share assistance to about 140,000 landowners each year. Many of the 140,000 private forest landowners each year to help them manage their land in a sustainable manner. And we address complex forest management issues through collaborative problem solving with the Minnesota Forest Resources Council and oversee implementation and monitoring of comprehensive site-level forest management guidelines. Those are some of the core functions of the Division of Forestry. Slide number 4 goes into priority outcomes and measures. We mentioned here that people and property are protected from wildfires. I think Bob Myers has probably said it at least a couple of different times that fire suppression and protecting people and property from wildfires is one of the highest, if not the highest, priority within the department. I just mentioned that the bar chart there, of course, shows the number of fires each year. FY07 is shaping up to be a real big year relative to the number of fires that we're experiencing. And of course, we still have very dry conditions now, and we have still a few months left of the fiscal year. So that's not good, but that's just the way it is, and we'll reprioritize as necessary and make sure that the fire suppression continues to be a high priority for the division, as well as others in the department to help out with that effort. In addition to fire suppression, there's also an awful lot of work that goes into prevention work and preparedness. We have a lot of work that we do with the fire departments around the state and helping enable them to be able to fight wildfires. We work a lot with them in moving federal surplus equipment to our organization, to theirs, to their individual fire departments out there. And we do a lot of training with them and incident command type of work with them as well. Moving on to slide number 5, another priority outcome to measure the sustainably managed forest, providing multiple benefits here. We use a full range of tools from timber harvesting, which is just what we perceive that to be, a tool, to special management areas to achieve various targets that we have. An example of the targets would be the cords of timber that we offer for sale, forest wildlife population levels that we work closely with the Division of Fish and Wildlife on those, and forest wildlife habitat enhancement, hunter satisfaction levels, which those things, of course, translate into. We also have high conservation value forests for both timber and biodiversity values. And we have, I believe the number right now is about 45,000 acres of old growth forest that's protected throughout the state. We are at this point in time looking at that relative to lowland conifers, so that number will probably increase in the near future. And in addition to that, of course, we work to help provide forest recreation opportunities in the state forest. There's numerous state forest campgrounds, primarily managed by Parks Division, but we have a bit of responsibilities there as well, a small responsibility there, and then also the trails have been a big workload, increased workload in the last couple of years. Slide number 6 is a kind of a key thing here that we wanted to point out, that basically DNR policies and plans are drive what we try to accomplish in the management of our state forests. So a lot of those policies and plans, of course, are embedded in legislation that comes from you folks, and, you know, it's all kind of vests down from that. We use a variety of tools to implement the management direction conveyed through DNR policy and plans, such as ECS classifications and silvicultural guides, silviculture, including various timber harvesting methods and different species types and different sites, special management areas, such as old growth management areas or high conservation value forests, and of course monitoring, where we basically do quite a bit of monitoring relative to forest conditions, wildlife, and plan implementation. And the application of these tools to carry out plans and policies results in providing, we feel, multiple outcomes and values from DNR forested lands. Moving on to slide number 7, as an example of our planning, a sustainably managed forest provides multiple benefits, and we have had in place for several years. Subsection Forest Resource Management Plans, the map there shows the different ones, the different subsections that we're working within. It's our goal to complete all 17 forested subsections by 2008, by the end of 2008. And with this, we integrate a broad diversity of forest outcome targets through our forest planning process. The subsection plans are a primary tool for determining the mix of value and products, such as wildlife habitat, rare features such as timber, that will be administered, be provided, and sustained through vegetation management on our DNR forested lands. Excuse me. Slide number 8 is sustainably managed, showing the forest certification efforts, of course, which were a big effort over the last 2 to 3 years, I think, in preparing for that and going through that. We of course, DNR is certified, became certified in December of 2005 under two separate third-party systems, both the Sustainable Forestry Initiative, or SFI, and the FSC, or the Forest Stewardship Council. The first surveillance audit was completed in October of last year, and from that we basically have learned of a few areas where we need to improve, and we're working towards improving in those areas, and I won't go into a lot of detail on that because I think you've heard quite a bit about our efforts with certification in the past. I would mention, though, and Mr. Meyer will come to this in a little bit with our initiatives, that one of the things with their private land management initiative is to try and bring certification to bear in some of the private lands as well. That's one of our goals for the next biennium. Moving to slide number 9, critical trends we're moving into now. Of course, I probably don't need to spend a lot of time. You've heard an awful lot about the changing forest ownership in northern Minnesota with the industries. Recognizing that the land is worth more now for recreational purposes or other purposes, other reasons than just producing fiber for the mills, as was originally a lot of the intent. And so there's a lot of changes going on there, and I won't elaborate at this point on those because, again, I think you've heard quite a bit about those over the last couple of months. Another critical trend on slide number 10, of course, is the wildfire demands in Minnesota. We, of course, endured a major fire season in 06. We involved over 500 staff within the department, plus 800 smoke chasers. We hired that many, about 800. In a typical year, we hire anywhere from 600 to 800 smoke chasers. These are individuals that will come to work for us anywhere from a few days up to a couple of months and work for us in helping to fight fires, wildfires. In the first quarter of fiscal year 07, our permanent staff in the Division of Forestry spent 9,000 more hours on fire work than in 06 in state regular salaries alone. So it was a very significant fire year. And as I mentioned earlier there, it doesn't look like it's boding too well for the spring season, which is typically the busiest time of the year for us relative to fires. We also help out with the Western situation when they have bad years. They in turn help us out when we have bad years here, and it kind of works out that way. And the other point that I guess that we want to make on here, and I know there isn't much that you folks can do about it, but just be cognizant of the fact that our DNR staff continue to age and impacting our capacity to meet increasing wildfire demands and our ability to advance our other forest management priorities such as private lands assistance and timber seal management, those sorts of things. Critical trend on, again, on slide number 11, private non-industrial lands are a key to the sustainable supply of forest of Minnesota timber. Some 147,000 individuals and organizations, excluding industry, I mean, to emphasize, these are non-industrial private forest lands that we're talking about here now, own 35% of Minnesota's forest land. Private lands have historically provided more than one half of the wood harvested in Minnesota, as the red-lined diamond symbols indicate there. The volume of wood harvested from private non-industrial forests in Minnesota has declined in recent years, and private non-industrial landowners who receive technical assistance are more likely to harvest timber, and that's why we put such a big emphasis, of course, on stewardship plan writing and additional technical assistance in that to help landowners make informed decisions and good decisions that are good for the environment, good for the timber, for their respective ownerships. Slide number 12 talks about a little bit about the changing forest products industry. Again, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here because I think you've already heard about this in previous hearings, but basically that it, as it points out, there's a lot of new investments outside of Minnesota. There's relatively high stumpage prices for Minnesota as compared to the wood, compared to outside sources. And, of course, recent shutdowns in Minnesota's timber mills are all contributing factors to this. We typically, the cycle, the wood economy, I guess, in Minnesota has kind of been ups and downs, but I can't say that I've seen, in my career, have seen a correction, if you will, that's as significant as the one that we're in right now. And I'm sure there's other people in the room that would say the same thing. Slide number 13, I think, is one that we wanted to put in here, which kind of shows the cycle here in it sets the stage, if you will, for Mr. Meyer and the initiatives that he's about to talk about. But basically, we first and foremost, we really need to have good data, good information on the forest, good inventory information out there that will help us then make good planning decisions through our SFRMP planning process. That's a subsection, Forest Resource Management Plans, or other multiple objective types of plans like that. Those in turn help us identify our annual work planning, and the annual work planning, which is the operational planning down there in the bottom right of that slide, relate obviously to the implementation, which is the site number of site visits. Each year we visit about 70,000 acres of sites to determine the exact vegetative management strategies that we want to incorporate on those 70,000 acres. From that, we offer about 35,000 acres of timber sales for sale. And as I mentioned earlier there, we actually plant and seed probably in somewhere in the 12,000 to 15,000 acres per year range. And we do forest improvement, other types of forest improvements such as intermediate stand treatments and things for those stands that are not yet ready, for example, for a harvest, where we might go in there and better prepare them to improve the health and productivity of the forest. And all of that, we do a fair amount of monitoring as well to make sure that we're following best management practices and that the plans have been implemented as we've suggested they will, and that the forest conditions are good, and all that relates back again up to the top of the good data and things that we use for making our decisions in the future. So with that, I guess one of the legislative initiatives.
Madam Chair, members, on slide 14, you'll see the change items in legislative initiatives as they relate to the Division of Forestry. There are several, so I want to dive right in. The first, as we've spoken of before when we began our budget processes, the forest management investments and DNR forest management activities. Part of this, you'll see on the fact sheet packets on page 21, deals with fully funding our forestry activities related to forest timber activities out of forest management investment account. Part of the 7.367 million is $3,167,000 reallocation for current activities that we're funding in 06-07 out of the general fund related to putting timber up to sale and the management of our state timberlands. So part of the 7.367, as I mentioned, is the 3.167 for the increased allocation of the forest management investment account. The next component of this change item deals with $750,000 for the staffing for additional field foresters to help us work on timber sales, primarily on timber sales, but they will be doing other forest stand improvements as well. Another piece of this is $1 million per year for forest improvement efforts, commercial and pre- and non-commercial thinning and seedling protection. Some of this will be done using private foresters, working with contractors throughout the regions to make sure we can get the work done in an expeditious manner to help our trees, help the growth, protection of those. $1.1 million per year will be for forest road maintenance. This is a one-time catch-up cost. We've asked for bonding dollars to pass two bonding bills. We have received some, but not nearly enough for us to complete the work that we need to do to maintain our infrastructure that's out there. This is a capital investment, just as roads and transportation systems are for any part of the state, making sure that we can not only access the timbered sales areas, but also so the people who are recreating in the forest, camping, hunting, bird watching, whatever they do, that they can get in there safely and without causing any damage. Mr. Tomlinson also mentioned $600,000. He mentioned the ecological classification system. We're looking to receive $600,000 to accelerate our ecological classification system. What we're looking to do, our fiscal year 2008 target, is to classify an additional 70,000 acres to identify forest potential, or potential, I should say, and guide best management practices for those forested areas. Another piece of this, and this is not, this slide is not in your packet, but it's in the fact sheet, is $350,000 per year to help us manage the invasive species on our DNR forest lands. We would like to establish a terrestrial invasive species program within the Division of Forestry, hire a coordinator to work within the division to deal with terrestrial invasive species, inventory our high-risk state forest areas for invasive species plants, and control invasive terrestrial plants, insects, and diseases on state-administered forest lands. The last section of this change item, Madam Chair, I believe that's a question.
Well, I'm sorry, Representative Southey.
I just have a question regarding, and maybe I just kind of have to back up a little bit, regarding forest improvement efforts. And you were talking just slightly about tree planting efforts. Did I hear that right, that you then, you know, at the time that you want to do some planting, you hire some outside contractors who would then get the job done more quickly? You could just nod if you hear that, if you think that's right. And my question then, the follow-up question to that, he did nod and say he thought it was right, but my follow-up question would be, since we have some people that have been out of work because of the mill closings, and maybe some of the tree cutters aren't able to work, would they then be some contractors that you could hire? And it would seem to make some sense to me, because in days past we used to have tree planting programs. And I'm just kind of wondering how, if we're doing enough tree planting programs to keep up with that, and if we could possibly hire those people who are out of work because of housing downturn.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, certainly we would consider hiring those folks. The key on it was we identify all the sites that need tree planting or seeding, and we put together contracts and then bid that out. And generally speaking, most of that contracts come from out-of-state vendors that are awarded those bids. These are professional tree planters, if you will, that start down in the southern states and work their way all the way up into Canada, just moving with the season as it goes along. And they are very, very capable folks that can plant, a few thousand trees per day in some pretty bad conditions, rocky soils and things like that. We have to walk through it. We're not talking about all machine planting here. So the long and short of it, we would certainly consider hiring anybody that wants to bid on these contracts, including loggers from up north. But I think a more apt to happen, though, would be to involve the loggers in the site preparation work, which we often require needs to be done before the actual tree planting can occur. And sometimes we will engage the loggers to go in there after a sale and do some brushing or something like that in order to kind of clean it up and do it that way. And I think that's more likely to be the scenario that would play out rather than the actual planting of the trees themselves.
Madam Chair, members, if you look on page 21 there on the bottom right, another area for them, and I think where it might be more applicable, is the pre-commercial thinning and stand improvement, to actually have them work with them to get into our forest and trim some branches, do a little thinning. This is activities that they're more associated with rather than the planting side. So we'll be looking there to try to figure out what kind of contracts and how we can improve the hiring of some of those people who have that expertise we need.
Before you go along, you had a slide that said, talked about sensitive areas for invasives. Help us out with what is high risk for invasives. What makes an area high risk?
Madam Chair, members, I'm not sure. I couldn't, and I don't. I guess I don't want to sit there and speculate on it and suggest that I'm an expert on it. But what we've talked about with the experts in the department and within the division is that certain areas are more high risk than others relative to the invasives coming in. To be honest with you, I'm just not sure how to answer your question.
Well, you can. Answer that later. It's just if you get that to us later, that would be fine. The other question that comes to mind when you're looking at this, when I'm looking at your tree planting, what's your loss to deer per year? What portion do you lose?
Madam Chair, members, again, I can't say how many we lose to deer. I know it's significant. And I can tell you that under that category of forest improvement, that we currently are spending about $500,000 a year on bud capping white pine, just to give you some example, kind of put things in perspective. That's where you take the little white piece of paper and put it over the terminal bud and clip it so that the deer don't munch the terminal buds. Our annual expenditure for that activity is about $500,000 using outfits like MCC and Sentence to Serve and other folks like that that I think we contract with for that purpose. It's very, very significant.
Okay, well, it would be good to have a proportion. I mean, are you losing a third? Are you losing a quarter? It would be just helpful to know that. Because on one hand, we are planting like mad, and on the other hand, we're reluctant to take as many deer as maybe we should. I mean, Representative Hansen, I hope you get a bunch of these deer. his deer feeding, his feeding program that he's working on. That's what I was thinking about. So it'd be nice to know what portion of the young trees we're losing.
And Madam Chair, I want you to be aware that when we're identifying what types of trees to plant in a certain area
mm-hmm.
or not to plant in a certain area, certainly our foresters are taking into consideration deer herd populations and the likelihood of how likely it'll be or not for the seedlings to survive out there. So. And that's not to say that I know we still have problems with deer predation on trees, but foraging on trees, I guess is a better word. But I could do some checking into that and get back to you on the
proportion. My understanding that you had in your eastern regions had particularly significant problems. We have two more questions.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on that, Mr. Tomlinson, a few years ago, I know there was an issue relating to white pine depredation on the plantations of white pine. And is the bud capping on the white pine that primarily where you're spending that money?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, bud capping is only done on white pine. Well, I'll say 95% done on white pine. It might be a little bit done on some of the other pines, but not much at all.
Madam Chair. So we're spending $500,000 because we've got a deer predation problem. I know that in my previous life we looked at trying to get some other, there were some conflicts with some other statutes that may have given you some other opportunity there. And then I think MCC folks were involved, but this is not easy work going out and capping the buds, and it's and it needs to be done in the kind of after the deer season, but before the munching really starts during the winter, if I remember correctly. I think this number's at $500,000 on capping when we're going to spend, you know, $350,000 on inventory. Where I know you're dealing with a lot of things, but I would be willing to work with you on trying to look at some of those other statutes that may have impeded your ability to have to only rely on the bud capping as a way of doing this, if there's a way of doing it a little differently.
The other thing is you mentioned that the Conservation Corps. Do you have a specific budget within this budget? Since we see no numbers here, it's very hard to ask the question. Do you have a specific number for that you set aside for Conservation Corps?
Madam Chair, we do. And I don't know what the number is, but it's out of the Forest Management Investment Account, some of the dedicated funds. I believe it's a certain small percentage of all the Natural Resource Fund, the accounts within Natural Resource Fund.
If you could get that to us later. We don't need it now, but it would be helpful to have that. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Tomlinson, I guess I just want to clarify for the other folks on the committee that under the Department of Ag's jurisdiction is the invasives for deciduous material, and the invasive issue is really yours in regards to some DNR property, but the statewide invasive issue of Jap beetle, gypsy moth, issues like that fall under the jurisdiction of the Department of Ag, correct? You have aquatics invasives, and then we get into a little bit of gray area when you deal with some of your own property, but I'm trying to give you a little cover when you didn't know all the answers to the invasives. I believe it's the Department of Ag's authority there.
Is that you suggesting you spend some amount of money out of this budget over to Ag?
Absolutely not, Madam Chair. We should have more money here. But I just wanted to clarify, I think the invasives, those pests that we were talking about, is not under your jurisdiction in DNR as a whole.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, thanks for the comment on that. I mean, you know, when Representative Wagenius asked the question, it was related to kind of what are the forest land areas that would be most prone to invasives, that sort of thing. See, not necessarily what types of invasives and things like that. And that's where I think, and not being an expert in this, I need to get back to it. But given your comment, I would just also mention that we do have a department shade tree bill coming before the legislature this session. And that basically is meant to better kind of align our roles and responsibilities relative to, amongst other things, invasives, as is Ag's roles and things. And the easy way to look at it is that Ag's responsibility is to try and keep invasives out of the state. But once they become established, terrestrial invasives become established in a state, then it becomes a DNR responsibility. So, for example, right now with the gypsy moth, agriculture is the lead agency relative to that because it's not yet established in the state. We still work very closely with them, but they're the lead agency in it. Once it does become established, like oak wilt did 20 years ago, or Dutch elm disease before that, then it'll become a DNR responsibility. It'd be more the front-running agency relative to that responsibility.
Madam Chair, members, the bill, Mr. Tomlinson speaks of it. It's a relief bill. We've been working with the Department of Agriculture on it. I believe Representative Loffler will be introducing for us. We will end up probably in this committee discussing that, and I'm in the process of working with Ag just on a fact sheet that, as Representative McNamara spoke of, to make sure that people clearly understand where those roles and responsibilities lie. So thank you, Representative McNamara, for teeing that one up for us. We appreciate it. The next piece, the last piece on the forest management investment account deals with accelerating the reinventory of DNR forest lands. Currently, right now, we have a cooperative scanned assessment program to inventory and assess the nearly 5 million acres of state land that we own right now. What this proposal will do will allow us to reduce the re-inventory cycle from once every 15 years to bring it down to once every 10 years by allowing us to complete an additional 100,000 acres of inventory a year. Actually, this should be that FY08 target should be FY08-09 target, I believe, Madam Chair. But it will allow us to get into the forest, making sure we're evaluating what's there, where it's at, what's growing, to help us know what we can put up for timber, what we don't need, what isn't ready to harvest yet, and manage it more in a sustainable manner across all of our lands. The next piece in the change items deal with general fund investment and DNR forest management investment activities. On page 31 of your packets, you can see what we're asking for here. This change will the change request from the forest land use account from an account within this natural resources fund to a special revenue account with statutory appropriations. The account was I'm on the wrong page. I'm sorry. No. I jumped to the wrong page. I had the wrong page number written down, Madam Chair. The general fund investment in DNR forest management, again, going back to general fund pieces, that's $1.5 million for a non-industrial private forest landowner assistance activities. We spoke of the plans we need to do working with these people who own the forested lands. And these aren't large landowners in many cases. They're the mom and pops or the people who have an 80 or 100 or 640 or whatever it is out in the forest. We need to make sure that they're managing their timber for conservation needs, but also for timber production, as you're well aware, and we try to stress that. A healthy working forest is also providing us with the conservation, habitat, and water quality protection efforts that we need out there. So we need to increase our efforts with those landowners and also our land asset management demands. As we deal with the fragmentation of the forest, as parcels get sold, you often see Cabela's or people selling forested lands out there. Cabela's is advertising land sales right now with some landowners up in northern Minnesota. The most highly valued pieces are those often within state forest lands that are completely surrounded by state forest land. Just as people want to live next to a park or a wildlife management area, they realize that they won't have anybody building next to them. They may have to share some of the fringes of the forest, but they have a sanctuary. That comes with it, roads, gates, trespass issues, developmental rights that they have. This $500,000 will help us deal with those issues as we face them. The people who buy these pieces of land, or as we work with them, our customers expect certain services, certain demands. They want things turned around in a certain amount of time. We need more money to help us manage with those needs, to help those people to meet their demands in a timely fashion. It's not something we enjoy doing, but we realize we have to provide that service to those landowners. Many times there will be a lease associated with it, perhaps through Lands and Minerals, to provide access through lands. Negotiating those terms, our foresters out in the field, also in working with Lands and Minerals, which doesn't get a piece of this, but this is for the forester activities, marking, measuring, assessing what is and what could be, where people want to go. So it's helping us meet the customer demands that we have out there right now.
Describe to me a little bit better who your customer is here.
Madam Chair, members, I think the customers are the citizens of the state. Keep in mind that a lot of the state forest lands don't have exact surveys around them, as a lot of the WMAs do and others like that that have been established in the last 20 or 30 years, say, for example. A lot of these state forest lands have been around for a long time. So, for example, if Forest Capital Partners up in northern Minnesota decides that they're going to sell off a number of 40s, and you get a number of different folks that come in, then they want to know exactly where that line is. We may end up sharing the cost of a survey along the edge there in order to help establish the exact area. That wasn't important when Forest Cap or prior to that Boise perhaps managed the lands. We needed to know it pretty close. But I think it's, you know, it's folks that have an interest in making sure that their ownership within existing state forests is well defined. That's one. I think it's for the public that wants to go up there and hunt and berry pick and otherwise use the state's forest lands, that they know exactly the boundaries of the state forest in a lot of cases when they butt up against private lands. That's more important perhaps than when it butts up against tax forfeited lands that the counties are managing or something. It may not be as important, but for those folks to use that to know those boundaries. And it's important for the folks that, for example, want to build something back in the woods and want to ask us for an easement across state forest land for the lights to get back in there. So I want to emphasize that what we're proposing, when we go out and talk to our folks in the field, because of the fact that there's more and more people moving out up north and into the forested areas of the state, our foresters tell us that the thing that is taking more and more of their time is answering the miscellaneous request for assistance miscellaneous request for easements and appraisals and surveys and those sorts of things like that. And this is meant to help relieve the pressure, if you will, on our core forestry folks out there so that they can continue to focus on the core forestry work and have a few folks that are more specialized in real estate management do a better job of that. And the other point I wanted to make with this request is that fully $300,000 of this request will go towards contracting outside sources for surveying and appraisal work relative to acquisitions and exchanges and sales of state forest land in some cases even. So in our effort to continually better consolidate our ownership in the state. Our state forest land ownership in the state.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And throughout much of the discussion, we've been talking about up north and kind of some of the issues that I see closer to my district or in areas where that I know are bluffland development in oak forests, forests in southeast Minnesota that are facing the same development pressures and the same type of needs. And I know your foresters there work very hard, so just want some assurance that we're not just all talking up north here, that we're dealing with the Mississippi River Valley and the Minnesota, and anywhere that's high with trees overlooking water seems to be a very popular place to go, and just like your comments on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, you're absolutely correct. Wherever we have forested areas of the state, we're working. We're working very closely with what's going on out there. If you look at maps of our state forests, they are located in the four corners of the state, everywhere. You go to our park areas, they're receiving the same pressures all the time. It's people wanting to their own little piece of paradise that deals with the pressures we have in parks. When we bring up our lands bill to discuss our lands bill, there's several issues dealing with trespass in the parks that we have to deal with to correct some of those things. People, unfortunately, sometimes build first and ask questions later about where they've built. So it's dealing with some of those issues. But the forested regions throughout the state are really what we're talking about here. And when I say up north, I mean anything north of St. Paul, but I should be saying around everywhere. So thank you for the correction.
Let me tell you one of the things that's troubling me a bit about this. If I'm buying land, normally I hire my own surveyor, and I don't purchase it without knowing where my boundaries are. I mean, that's my responsibility as a purchaser. It's unusual to hear you say that you think that's part of the state's responsibility to pay for surveys for customers when these are individuals buying land, and why aren't they out on their own? I mean, that's an unusual practice.
Madam Chair, I should clarify that. We help sharing the cost oftentimes of surveying state boundaries along private pieces when we are about to harvest timber, and it's a benefit to us to make sure that the line is exactly in the right place to know where it's going to go to. And that's probably more likely to be the case where we would actually share in the cost with private landowners. I'm trying to think of examples where we might otherwise share, but I can't think of any right at the moment.
Well, you began by saying yeah. Your customers now expect more services, and you use the Force Capital Partners, so mm-hmm. I got stuck in that.
Thanks for bringing that back to my attention, and I probably misspoke on that. But I think the main point that we want to make here with this is that what we're looking for is probably three highly specialized positions that know about real estate management transactions and how to go about them, locating them in each of the three regions that forestry operates out of in the state. And to have those people available to help take the workload off the area forestry folks out there so that they don't have to do as much in that. And one of the primary things that I really want to emphasize with this is our desire to better consolidate our ownership. So you've heard a lot of different times that we have many parcels that are remote, scattered parcels, far removed from the boundaries perhaps of the state forest. Maybe it's in our interest, and I emphasize maybe it's in our interest to sell those pieces off and then turn around and buy other pieces that are in holdings within the state forest, which will help us better manage, have less management problems associated with managing the state forest. And the other thing, of course, is key access, that we want to improve the access in the large blocks of state forests, and sometimes we can do that better by working with willing sellers who are willing to sell us access through their property along it. In that case, it might be easements, or it might be fee title acquisition, the 40s or 80s, and that sort of a thing. That, I think, is really the kind of work that we envision taking place in a lot of this, with these efforts over the next several years.
Madam Chair, and I apologize for my confusion. It's on page 19 of our fact sheets that describes these activities, the land asset management demands, and it's these types of things that once our land record management system is up and running will help us do this a lot more efficiently, effectively, and have the best up-to-date data available at our fingertips. So it's just an example of how that system will benefit just a small part of our work right here.
When we did our LCC MAR bill, we asked if easements could be just sent electronically. Piece of cake. Do you all accept down here easements sent electronically from as they're filed?
Madam Chair, members, I'm not sure about that. I'd have to check with our land manager, Lands and Minerals Division, as they maintain all of our real estate transactions. I'll get back. I'll put that in our list of questions that are there.
LCCMR did not seem to think that that would be a problem to do at all, and they were going to manage it with their computer that they already had and with the staff that they already had. And they certainly, the number of easements
and purchases in the LCC Marville is large, not a small, because it's a lot of smaller pieces.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As long as you mentioned LCC Mar, I thought I'd just give you the quick update that it will be heard on the House floor on Thursday. And it's got an off hearing in the Senate Thursday afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Moving forward, the Sustainable Forest Resource Act authorization, reauthorization and implementation represents a $1.18 million change in 08 and $780,000 in 09. This chapter of law is set to sunset this year if we don't reauthorize it. If you turn to page 25 of your fact sheet packet, you can see what we're looking to do. Chapter 89A is the Sustainable Forest Resource Act, which was passed over a decade ago and really helps us frame our forestry activities today. It has many of the things that we're working with to make sure we have a sustainable harvest and can do what we need to do. It also contains the Forest Resource Council. If this act is a sunset, we will lose the Forest Resource Council, which represents $780,000 of those funds right there. So that the Forest Resource Council, they do a lot of work managing the pieces of the act that are there. You can see on the fact sheet, it's made up of the Forest Resource Partnership, Timber Harvesting and Forest Management Guidelines, Landscape Level Forest Resource Planning, Coordination, Monitoring, and Interagency Information Cooperative. They're housed over at the University of Minnesota, and we need to continue the funding on this. The other two pieces of why there's a difference between 08 and 09, you'll see in the top right-hand column, $200,000 of that is for a one-time allocation to conduct a study for options dealing with the fragmentation and parcelization of our state or our forested land, and $200,000 is for a one-time allocation for the Forest Resources Research Advisory Committee to provide direction on research topics recommended by the Governor's Task Force on the Competitiveness of Minnesota's forest products industry. The Forest Competitiveness Task Force, their recommendations are reflected in the governor's budget almost in their entirety. What had happened is we submitted our budget before they were done with their recommendations. After their recommendations came out, we compared what we had and where we were at, and it was really, really close. You'll see a couple things that are in here that we will highlight that weren't in our initial budget but that were in the Competitiveness Task Force. Some of the new one-time dollars that are there to do that, a couple of these are reflective of that in their nature. These change items are the Sunset Act, and a couple of the next change items you're going to see in policy bills, actually. Repealing the sunset provision of Chapter 89A is in the DNR forestry bill, as well as balsam bough buyer permit fees, which I'll discuss here in a few minutes, and also the forest resources or firewood restriction or firewood ban in state parks has a budget impact that'll be shown in your books of $55,000 per year. Also, I'm not sure why it's not. A couple of the other change items that were on page 14 that aren't in the presentation, false about buyer permit fees, is actually a $250 change item, changing the way, and Mr. Reinholz laughed that we're even talking about $250, but we're changing the way the permits will be established and just issuing them to recover our costs. The Forest Resource Assessment Account, we're establishing an account to capture some funds from our resource assessment activities, our ortho photos. People request maps from our resource center in Grand Rapids. Currently, the funds go to three different accounts. We want to direct them into one account so we can access and account for them more efficiently. State forest land use, we want to get some increased funding related to our abilities, what we're doing there. This relates to another change item that was passed several years ago, allowing us to establish fees for people to use for activities within the forest, dog sled races, geocaching, motocrosses, whatever. We passed language that allows us to charge for those activities for us to recover the costs. to make sure if there's any damage done, that damage is repaired. We didn't establish an account for these dollars to go into, so that's why we're doing that there. And also a piece of the ATV gas tax funds, $50,000 in the first year and $100,000 second year, will be used for county and state forest road maintenance and repair. So that's also tracked under forestry as well. We talked a little bit about the FY0809 pie chart that we had, and we've also handed this out so you can compare 07 and 08. And then this sheet here, this is a summary page. You can see current spending in 07 and 08, 65, 662, and 52, 239. I should say that's 06, 07. If you compare down on the bottom, the 69, 381, and 68, 86, the current spending for 08, 09. The difference, you can see the top line there, current spending, far right column, approximately $118 million. What we're looking for, total biennial expenditures, $137,467,000 for 08, 09 for the Division of Forestry. Madam Chair, members, if there are no further questions, we can move on to operations support and then go from there. Madam Chair, our operations support presentation, I believe, is in front of you. Need to get it in front of me here. And I'd like to bring up Denise Anderson, who's our Chief Financial Officer and also in charge of our Office of Management and Budget Services, whose staff not only composes and develops our strategic conservation agenda, they also help pull together all these presentations that we use throughout the legislative process. So I just want to say thank you to their staff, for Denise allowing her staff to help me and work through all of these questions and presentations that we have. It is a substantial amount of workload during certain times of the year, so I just want to say thank you to them while I have the opportunity.
All right. Good evening, Madam Chair and members. My name is Denise Anderson, and as Bob mentioned, I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Natural Resources. And I'm here tonight to present to you operations support, of which my unit, Office of Management and Budget Services, is one of several units that make up operations support. What operations support does is provide leadership and critical services to divisions in support of their natural resource management goals. It consists of the Commissioner's Office, which provides executive direction to the department, human resources. We have the Office of Management and Budget Services, which consists of financial and budget services, along with some science, policy, and research. Then we have information and publications and regional ops. Our pie chart for 0607, the largest piece of it is from the Environment and Natural Resources. And those are pass-through money that gets passed through for recreational and local initiative grants. The rest of the pie chart is a mirror of the type of funding that the department receives. We get a portion of it from the general fund, which is $10.5 million. We get a portion of it from the natural resources fund and a portion of it from game and fish. The next set of slides describes some of the trends and outcomes tied to the core functions of op support. There are several critical trends that influence the workload within operations support. And again, these trends mirror a lot of the trends that you've seen throughout the different programs. We have advances in science, technology, and information management. We have an aging workforce that we're managing. We're accountable to results. The citizens have a higher expectation for our performance and our fiscal integrity, and so that drives some of our workload within op support. And then integrated resource management. So each of the units within Op Support provides a diverse type of service. And so the outcomes that we're presenting here are some of tied to the key activities that Op Support provides. The first one of the most important activities is performance measurement and management. And so as many of you are familiar with our strategic conservation agenda, a lot of the information that you've seen presented throughout the programs has been tracked within the conservation agenda, has over 90 performance indicators. And this type of information is used to help clearly communicate our department's outcomes. And we are planning to update the agenda this year in March of 2007. On the next slide, related to our fleet management services. And one of the things that Internal Services attempts to do is to provide services more cost-effectively throughout the department. And our fleet program is a good example of that. It's ranked in the top 100 best fleets in North America. And one of the key accomplishments that they've had over the past few years is we've reduced the debt. We had a total debt level of $11 million in 2002, and that was reduced to zero in 2007, which saves us close to $500,000 a year in debt service costs. And this was done by the sharing of fleet across the department and right-sizing our fleet and managing our fleet usage through the rates. So our goal for 2008-2009 is to maintain a zero debt level.
Madam Chair, members, just quickly, this is one of the key successes we like to celebrate, because by doing this, it allows us to spend $500,000 more on conservation, habitat, recreation needs, and not pay interest. Fleet, our IT, and safety issues are coordinated through management resources, which is led up by Elaine Johnson. I just want to introduce you to Elaine. Her staff works very hard on all of these issues, and one of the reasons we were able to be so successful on this and a couple other things is the creation of the facilities management account that the legislature allowed us to pass several years ago. You're going to see a similar initiative coming forward with Op Support here in a few minutes, talking about how we're doing our governance, and it's similar to the next step of accountability, entrepreneurialism within the department, allowing divisions to be more proactive in the way that they manage their services. So this fleet thing, the slide, you know, is pretty, but it's a huge thing for us. So to manage our fleet without paying debt is something that we're very proud of. We drive 17 million miles a year as a department. It's, you know, several, I don't know, 10 times around the circumference of the earth or something, but that number just amazes me. We have 1,800 passenger vehicles, 210 permanent employees using those, but we also have 2,000 seasonal employees that need transportation. So looking at fleet, looking at how people get to work, making sure they're safe, making sure that they're doing the right things, that they have heating, air conditioning, roofs over their heads, it's an amazing thing when you look at those things and be done. So it's something we like to celebrate. Just moving quickly on, the safety thing we talked about, we're really doing a superb effort, I think, in reducing our safety. It's never where it needs to be, but we are below our target. You know, our folks work with chainsaws and dangerous stuff out there, so we need to make sure that their safety and doing things safely and having a safety message and moments is something we work on all of our teams that are out in the field to do. You can see our incident rate is the number of recordable injuries and illnesses per 200,000 hours worked. Our target is to keep that 5.7 or below. Information technology and leadership, again, technology, computers, we talked about our land record management system. Databases, design and administering GIS activities, broad and secure access to DNR data and information, computer user support training consultation, IT standards and best management practices, build and manage the DNR network infrastructure. It's a huge thing, just the number of computers that we have, and managing all of our assets and technology is something we don't take lightly. The next slide just talks about our leadership there. Resource managers using high-quality and up-to-date geographic information system tools to effectively manage the state's natural resources. You're going to get a little taste of this. One of our staff, Tim Loesch, is going to be presenting at the upcoming LCCMR meeting, talking about how we integrate with other GIS users in the state and in state government to make sure we aren't duplicating things, making sure we have what we need. And brief example of that, the maps that you have with all of your districts and information, pictures and everything on there, we access that map and we put all of our parks and regional boundaries on there. If you're interested in a map like that that shows the state with our regional boundaries and state parks, let me know and I can get you that file. That was through coordination with the land management system or the GIS staff in the legislature and our GIS staff. So it's just a small example, but it helps me out a ton when I try to figure out where the issues are. Fiscal accountability, percentage of bills paid within 30 days. This is largely within Denise's shop. 97% of the bills, it's just a measure out there that we try to maintain or exceed. And integrated resource management. This is where we're at. If you think of, I think it was about a month ago now, we started this process of budget presentations maybe, but the integrated resource management, adaptive management, the three circles that we had, resources, economics, and conservation. This is where we really operate, interdisciplinary teams used to make sure that all of our priorities are on target. Science-based presentations, research on identifying, tracking emerging outdoor recreation issues, and important social economic trends. Denise's organization or shop has our economists are focused in there who help us with our trend lines that we use. Also looking at the recruitment and retention efforts. We did some research there that really alarmed us, and we've talked a lot about it in the past couple of days. Not only our hunter and fisher people, but people using our parks, people using our trails, our water access sites. It's all changing, as we all know. Our demographics are constantly changing, and we need to make sure that we can handle that. Regional results, a couple key successes here. UMore South, Representative McNamara's guidance and everyone's appreciative support through the UMore project, getting us into a high-quality, large area in the southern metro area is going to be huge, working to make sure that we can maintain that. The field research enhancement, year-round public access, high-quality hunting experiences, high-quality woodlands. Our operation management support staff helped guide that process to get us to where we are today, coming in with a management plan and actual language and a bill to designate that as the Vermilion Hills Research, Wildlife, and Recreation Area. It was a huge challenge. I thought it was an undaunting process to go through, sit down with U of M, Dakota County, and other stakeholders to come up to an agreement, but it actually went smoother than anybody anticipated. As I mentioned, the operation support reallocation is a budget-neutral proposal. What we're trying to do is make sure that our operation support, that our division directors, all the ones that you have seen and talked with on their budgets, have the ability to guide the decisions regarding the quality of service, level of service, and the cost of services that they get through operation support. If you go back to the beginning slide that Denise had talking about human resources, management resources, information, and education. We're basically focusing on the HR, the information and education pieces that are out there right now. I do have a spreadsheet I can hand out that kind of shows the unraveling of this and then the re-raveling of it, shows where the money comes from and where it goes to in each division. If the committee is interested, we can hand those out now or we can hand them out afterwards. It is a budget-neutral proposal. What we're really doing is making sure that the division directors have the ability to manage those costs that are there. Madam Chair, while this is being distributed, I'll just kind of go through some of the summary numbers. The proposal is $5,418,000 in total, and it's being distributed through each division based upon their historic spending for what they've spent on these services in the past. So it's really, I don't know if it's the last piece of our business kind of reform, but it certainly is another way to help the division directors become more accountable and have more of a say in the services that they're having and that they utilize. They'll be purchasing through reimbursing Office of Management Budget Services for the activities that they get from them. As you have the sheets in front of you, you can see it's broken down by biennium, by general fund, and actually by the three main accounts, the water rec account, the snowmobile account, and the game and fish fund account. And it, then it goes back into the divisions. Madam Chair, this last slide here, or second to last slide, I think, talks about the pie chart for 0809 for operation support. It's made up of all the different funds that we have in the department kind of being redirected into operation support for the activities that they do. Total of $16.3 million. And then the spending chart, you can see the reductions are due to the transfer of dollars back to the divisions again. So that's why you're going to see we're not able to compare apples to apples with this. You'd have to take the operation support piece for each division to get to the total numbers. But if you need more information on that, we can certainly get that to you. Madam Chair, if there's no questions on that, I'd just like to spend a few minutes kind of wrapping up where we started and hopefully where we're going here. I do have one other sheet that I'd like to distribute dealing with the general fund budget reallocation. This was not available at the time we discussed this proposal, but I think it'll help you as you hopefully keep it in your books. It's a similar spreadsheet that we developed in the Senate as we were talking about the general fund budget reallocation. Shows where we started and by division what we're putting back into each division as general fund dollars.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner Meyer and Ms. Anderson, just kind of backing up for a second on the operations support. I appreciate the information you said about the $500,000 in savings on the debt service and that basically that's going back into environmental programs. Kind of a related question. I know that last December there was a health care benefits holiday for all state employees because of how the health care benefits were negotiated. I'm wondering what a difference that made for your agency and if it got reallocated similar to like this debt service funds or what happened within your agency with that.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, I don't have that information right offhand. I'll get it to you
later,
as soon as I can.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Moving on at just the operations support reallocation page, this is just a reference document for you to see as we've discussed the different pieces that are out there and how it all fits back together again. I just wanted to provide this to you in case you saw one of your colleagues in the Senate with a piece of information that you didn't have. I want to make sure that everybody has the same stuff, so we've been giving them the same presentations that we've been going through over here. The agency-wide legislative initiatives, the DNR budget reallocation, the operations support we just talked about, compensation adjustment and maintenance of service. These are two pieces that you see in each division budget as well, dealing with the cost, the salary costs that we're anticipating. And while we're on that note, I do need to give the committee one more piece of information regarding our FTE complement. It was brought to my attention that when we loaded our budget, we did not include the FTE complement with the maintenance of service included. We did not know if that was going to be included or not. So we represented the numbers that were presented into the system showed an overall decrease, I believe, of about 80 FTEs. We've reworked that. I don't have copies available right now, Madam Chair, but I will include it in our response to you, showing what the current biennial budget, their 0809 FTE complement will be, provide you more detailed information on that just so you're aware of that. The maintenance of service is something non-general fund that if we do not get through our dedicated accounts will have impacts on the level of service provided to our customers because we will have to go back and re-examine those FTE complements. Previously discussed, we also talked about agency-wide issues, our land record management system, the ATV gas tax issue, clean water legacy, and ethanol water supply issues. I do have answers coming to many of those questions, to all of the questions that we had regarding some of those things. So I'm hoping now that I won't be here in the mornings with you, I can be in my office getting those responses ready. So, but I will be here, don't worry. The reallocations we've talked about, land asset management, non-motorized forest recreation trails, Project Wild providing some funding for the UMOR proposal, environmental review coordination, shifting of our treaty costs from game and fish fund to general fund, operation support, we just reviewed this slide, and maintenance of service, again, there's 2% general fund across the board, and we've also asked finance, and they approved a 3.25% out of our dedicated funds to help us balance where we anticipate that number may be. And the land record management system, we talked about this. The $701,000 of new dollars we needed to do those works, those activities. Clean Water Legacy, again, using the $1.63 million as a base, we did a $370,000 internal reallocation based on our general fund. Internal reallocation to meet the needs that we've identified to get the water assessed in the state of Minnesota as fast as possible. And Madam Chair, the agency summary, this is just a different way of looking at some of those proposals in total. But you can see overall current spending 06-07, $636 million roughly, 08-09, about $688 million. Again, the pie chart that we had just represents the total FY 08-09. 38% game and fish, 21% natural resources, general fund 3.4%. Oh, I'm sorry, total revenue by fund. Thank you, Denise. Where our money comes from, and then just so you can see, you know, game and fish is 40% roughly of the money that we take in. General fund is a small percentage overall. The big drivers of change, we've really been stressing these, and I want to thank the members for the questions that you have provided to us. It does help us understand some of the pressures that you are sensing out there and what the drivers are that you have. But there are some opportunities as well, as we have listed on the bottom, the energy biofuels issue. I really think it's something that in the next decade will really be changing the way the DNR looks at the land assets that we have. How can we make, how can people have benefits of kind of a harvesting of an energy source while providing conservation habitat is something we're really, really, really hoping that it all comes together. The roadside for wildlife is an area that we can just expand exponentially with a little biofuels component to it. Those things that we've heard, allowing those native prairie grasses to be grown on our lands. Hope we can help us pay pilt maybe in the future. I don't know. Interconnected resources. We talked about the integrated solutions using the forestry example. Again, it's all connected. It really all is. Everything that we do provides benefits to water quality, to habitat, and to economic and sustainable uses out there. Focus on results. And that's it. Thank you very much. That was kind of quick, but I know you've seen all of those before, so.
You may have worn us out. Congratulations.
I didn't think it was possible.
It's a fairly quiet evening here. But someone is going to change the tune.
I have a slate of questions for the DNR. Actually, I'm just kidding, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair. I just want to make one comment, if I could. The DNR has done a lot of good things, and we appreciate all your hard work in bringing this information to us. I just wanted to go back, I don't know, about 10 minutes ago, you talked about hunter retention, and I just wanted to say nice things about Ryan Bronson, because I know there are a lot of great employees at the DNR, but hunter retention is really important, and Ryan does a great job with that, so I wanted that to be on the record.
Chair, Representative Hoppe, thank you.
Anybody else want to say something nice?
About Ryan Bronson?
Just a plug for our upcoming strategic conservation agenda with our updated outcomes. We'll be getting that out to you in March. Probably by CD to begin with, as it's going to be a little bit of a lag time and a duplication, but so you can do that. We're also looking at a comparative table. Hope it works out so you can see the 04 outcomes, the 05 outcomes, 06, and link them all together so you can see where we're going with what we're doing, our measurable trends.
Super. I don't see any other questions, so I'm going to ask Representative Hoppe, who is in good humor, if he would move the minutes from the previous meeting.
Madam Chair, I would love to move the minutes from the previous meeting. I've been reading them all night.
I thought you have. Any objection? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are adopted. I see no further questions. Have a good evening, folks.